Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Rosemary Mosca. She's a science communicator, author, and creator of the webcomic Bird and Moon. And she has written and illustrated a pocket guide to pigeon watching, getting to know the world's most misunderstood bird. Rosemary, this is a brilliant guide, and I mean that sincerely. This is fun, it's funny, and it's got a huge amount of ethological and genetic information on it. Is this your first guide?
Yeah, it is. Thank you. That's really flattering. It was intimidating to put together a guide.
But it seems effortless. But yeah. The genius behind it is it seems effortless.
Well, I was going for a book that people would see and think, oh, this would be a fun book to have around. And then the science would kind of sneak up on them and pounce.
Oh, and there's a lot of it. You've got some. Yeah. You've got hardcore genetic stuff in here.
My wonderful editor helped me reduce that from about twice as much content. There was an extensive amount. I think the genetics is fascinating.
It is fascinating.
But maybe, you know, not everybody needs to know every single detail on that.
Well, I would argue that people need to know some genetics by this time in our civilization. I mean, DNA is like what makes the world go around.
Yeah. Well, that was one of the most interesting parts to me because it explains the coloration of the domestic pigeon or the feral pigeon.
And that's so complicated. It's so complex.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really only scratched the surface because people who have been breeding fancy pigeons for thousands of years have their own, you know, giant tomes about it.
Oh, yeah.
So I just hinted at it.
No, people are going to ask, and I suppose I have to pose the question, but I know the answer. Why pigeons?
It's absolutely, I get asked this a lot, but it's absolutely fair because you look at a pigeon, you know, and you may not think, oh, that's a very exciting bird, or you may even think, oh, that's a dirty bird that's walking around on the ground, you know, being kind of yucky and eating hot dog buns. But so I grew up in cities and I also grew up a bird watcher and I couldn't help but notice the pigeons. And then as I learned a little more about them and I learned about their history and their place in, you know, human history and human experience, I realized that there is no other bird that is more misunderstood and more unfairly, you know, treated. So,
it is
so I kind of wanted to be a bit of an advocate.
Plus, they're all around us, unless you live far out into the country. And so it's a great bird to start watching because you're going to bump into it a lot. And unlike a lot of other birds, you can, if you have a handful of peanuts, you can closely approach them.
Yeah. And a lot of folks, you know, don't realize that that's because they were bred for 5,000 plus years to be good companions for us. So they really want to be around people. And that's partly why they're found near people and not, say, you know, in the redwood forests or something like that.
Well, and they're a type, first of all, we should say they're a type of dove. And the whole dove family is fascinating, as you mentioned in your book. And you have these wonderful illustrations of the pigeon family. The story of the passenger pigeon still is one of the, one of the freakiest stories of extinction.
Yeah, I kind of got a new perspective on it when I was writing this book, because the story I was told about the passenger pigeon, which is our native, you know, one of our native North American pigeons, unlike the city pigeon, was that it, you know, it's the sad story of we sort of destroyed their habitat and they disappeared and, you know, no one was really at fault or sort of, it was sort of a vague, hand-wavy story. But one thing that I learned was that what was going on was that indigenous people were consuming a lot of passenger pigeon and sustainably managing them. Various, you know, indigenous people, the Seneca people especially. And then when colonists came over, they basically ate the passenger pigeon to death. They also cleared the habitat. But it's because, you know, colonial folks were eating a lot of pigeon. And that's also one of the reasons why they brought over the city pigeon. And then these days we think, ew, you know, who eats pigeon? But people used to.
Well, they still do in France and in places. It's squab. It's cuisine.
Yeah, absolutely. And in parts of the Middle East, it's still a delicacy. So if you sort of, if you look at pigeons and you think, ew, but you eat other birds, you know, I think that's a cultural thing, and you need to sort of be aware of that for sure.
There's other great members of the pigeon family that you illustrate. First of all, and I love your illustrations. Your illustrations perfectly suit this guide.
Thanks so much.
If you ever go to Australia and some of the islands in the Pacific, the dove family goes wild. I mean, they come out in oranges and greens. They have strange head feathers. I mean, it's really amazing what pigeons, the diverse families that the dove family is.
Yeah, they're really spectacular. And I think it's, as much as I love our city pigeons, I go through a whole explanation about why it's a bit of a shame that we call that bird the pigeon, you know, given that there are so, so many beautiful doves and pigeons and other birds. So the dodo bird has been sort of reclassified as a member of the pigeon and dove family, Columbidae. And yeah, there are all sorts of incredible, you know, multicolored, bright, bright, bright pigeons, you know, all over the world. There are big ones and small ones and colorful ones and drab ones. And they can, you know, just be an absolute cascade of rainbow feathers like the Nicobar pigeon. So it's a pretty spectacular family for sure.
I think one of my favorites is the Victoria crowned pigeon. That is...
Oh, gosh, yeah.
It's blue. It's got this wild crown on its head. It's beautiful.
Yeah, they're almost like a fever dream of our city pigeons.
You're right. Huge
ground walking bird with a spectacular crest, and they're sort of gray blue, but like to an extreme. Yeah,
yeah, it's like if our pigeons took Molly, that's what they would look like. You have a wonderful history of humans and pigeons. And even though it's a brief history, it really explains about it. Do we know how early pigeons were domesticated?
That was something I was really trying to get at, and it turns out that we don't. We think that it could go no earlier than the dawn of agriculture in the Fertile Crescent, because pigeons love to be around people and to feed on the grains that people spilled, and that was around where they were domesticated. So the Fertile Crescent is this, you know, region of the Middle East. And then we have evidence of domestication around 4,000 to 5,000 years ago. So I'm lucky my aunt and uncle are Egyptologists, and they put me in touch with an Assyriologist.
Oh, wow.
I went back as far as I could, but we're bumping up against the dawn of recorded writing in that region. So we have hints, but we know it was a long, long time ago. And so at some point, that's why I like to say, you know, probably 5,000 plus years. But could have been much longer.
Now, they were domesticated for several reasons. First of all, they were domesticated just because people like to domesticate animals and have them around as pets. They were domesticated for meat, but they were also domesticated for guano.
Yeah, that pigeon poop that we hate when it's all over our statues was at one point something really, really valuable. So yeah, domestication probably happened at different times in different places. It's a much more complicated process than what I had initially imagined, which is, you know, one person connected emotionally with one pigeon sort of had this romantic moment, and you know, then the rest.
Although, according to your book, that has happened.
I mean,
I was thinking of Nikola Tesla.
Nikola Tesla, yes, yeah, who never fell in love with a human, but did in fact fall in love with one beautiful white pigeon who he rescued, and he said he loved her like a man loves a woman. Yeah, that was one of the wildest things.
I don't know.
That's uncovered.
That borders on extremely creepy too.
He was a quirky fellow. I mean, you have to admire.
That was being very politic. That was being very.
I was definitely trying to also be politic in my book, because he also describes that when she passed away, lasers came out of her eyes, and she glowed. And anyway,
wow.
It's pretty remarkable.
Whoa.
But yeah, we definitely, you know, domesticated them for the purposes that you mentioned and for the poop. And the poop was useful for, fertilizing fields.
Yep.
So, you know, especially if you're in an area that's kind of arid or doesn't have the right soil nutrients, you dump that stuff on your fields and it's incredible for fertilizer. You could grow melons and vegetables and all kinds of stuff. So not only would you eat pigeons, but then the veggie sides or the fruit dessert would be also from pigeon poop.
And people actually constructed specific cages, well, dovecotes, they called them, to host pigeons.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Pigeons can't live really in kind of a regular chicken coop or a bird cage because the native, the original pigeons nested in the sides of cliffs, basically in holes in the sides of cliffs. So they like a flat surface and they like a little hidden sheltered niche. So you basically create an indoor cliff when you're raising pigeons. So you make kind of like a wall with little little niches for the pigeons. And the original dovecotes were sort of caves with little holes in them, almost like a like an absurd beehive with all these little niches.
Neat.
And the pigeons would be breeding in them. And they are just really fascinating structures that have all sorts of different designs all over the world.
And pigeons also worked for us. And you have a nice little history of pigeons and message carrying.
Yeah, it's this fascinating thing. We know that if you take a pigeon far away from its nest and release it, it will fly home, you know, with great speed and accuracy. And we don't really know how they do it. We have a few hints that, you know, it was that they use landmarks or that they use potentially odor, you know, and potentially magnetism and all this stuff. They kind of use a bag of tricks. But they get home really, really quickly. So if you attach a very lightweight note to them, they will carry that message to, you know, that spot where they nest really, really efficiently. And up until pretty recently, they were considered essential tech and especially essential wartime tech. So soldiers would bring them into battle, you know, and it kind of reached new heights in World War One and World War Two, where, you know, you wouldn't go into war without some pigeons that you could release to send back to base if something went awry. And a bunch of these pigeons wound up being released in times of extreme duress and saving whole companies of soldiers with, you know, ceasefire notes or whatever. It's really amazing.
And that means, and I love reading this in your book, there are decorated war hero pigeons.
I mentioned a few of them, but there were so many. I honestly thought I can't list every one that I find. There's so many. World War One and World War Two. There's these photos of these pigeons with you know, medals around their necks that are like absurdly large. But at one point, ordinary people knew the names of Cher Ami or G.I. Joe or Mary of Exeter or Winky or all these, you know, decorated war hero pigeons. They were like, you know, I don't know what the equivalent is, like the Lassie or the Grumpy Cat or something of today. Everybody knew them.
What's Fus Your Deuce?
I had to throw that in the last.
I'm so glad you did because I didn't know it. And I feel like I have to use that phrase somewhere.
Yeah, it's a thing people say in Scotland. It's Fus a Doric expression, meaning essentially, you know, how are you doing? And it sort of means like, how are your doves or how are your pigeons doing? And then I don't know how to pronounce the reply, but it basically means like, oh, they're pecking away. You know, oh, they're good. Like, we're good, which is so charming to me. Because that's just from the time when people had pigeons. You know, everybody had pigeons.
Amazing. My guest tonight is Rosemary Moscow, science communicator, author, creator of the webcomic Bird and Moon. And she has written and illustrated a wonderful guide, a pocket guide to pigeon watching, getting to know the world's most misunderstood bird. This is WICN 90.5. You also have a great sort of introduction into basic pigeon biology and anatomy. One of the first things that you can notice as a novice pigeon watcher is their iridescent neck patch. It's really beautiful.
Yeah, it's stunning. I feel like if you're not a fan of pigeons, you can't help but like at least that part of a pigeon.
Yeah.
That glorious purple and green shininess. And it's fascinating. It's used probably to indicate, you know, health and to show off to a pigeon's partners, you know, check out my fancy colored feathers. But it's more amazing than I realized because each one of those feathers is capable of shining either green or purple depending on the angle. And some of them look green from straight on and some of them look green from the side. So it's just this like glittery, beautiful display that is, I think, a feast for the eyes, if I can say that.
Well, is it? It's similar to a hummingbird's gorget?
I think it's, yeah, it's somewhat similar in that, you know.
Because they, depending upon the angle, like just for the ruby throats that we have around here, it can look black, it can look red, it can look iridescent.
Yeah, I think that's really true. I think what's interesting about the pigeon stuff is that there are two distinct colors that at least we can see that change. But yeah, it's a similar sort of iridescent structural coloration. And I think, you know, as much as we admire the hummingbirds, we can admire the pigeons.
Now, I have to, there's so much we could talk about pigeon anatomy and pigeon sort of behavior. But I want to talk about crop milk and the crop. Because I knew about this beforehand. But if people don't know it, it is an amazing and bizarre thing. Talk to me about what crop milk is.
It's my favorite fact about pigeons, bar none.
Why am I not surprised? And no pun intended, but it does crop up a lot in the book.
Oh, I like that. I don't think I used a lot of puns, but I don't think I used that one. Oh, that would have been great. Yeah, so it's a pigeon has an area of its esophagus called the crop, which is a very useful area. If you're a pigeon and you see a bunch of food and you want to fly away and eat it somewhere safer, you can just swallow a bunch into your crop and fly off. But in both male and female pigeons, there is the ability to secrete milk into that crop area, and then they kind of puke it into their baby's mouths for the first few days of their baby's lives. And I kind of enjoy telling people that pigeons make milk and then pausing and watching the gears turn as they think, they don't have udders, though.
Let's go milk a pigeon.
Yeah, you don't want to do that.
What is it?
Well, so it's
milk. Is it similar to milk, or is it just being called milk?
No, it's absolutely similar. It's a convergently evolved milk, which means convergent evolution is essentially when you know, different species evolve the same feature capability unrelated to each other. So it's fascinating because it's kind of a kind of creamy yellowish color, and it's kind of chunkier than mammalian milk, but it is stimulated by the same hormone, so the hormone prolactin, and it has fats and proteins, and it promotes a healthy immune system, and it's got antioxidants.
I'm surprised then it isn't being sold somewhere for people to eat.
Well, I did learn that the genetics behind it have been decoded, and so we could potentially produce it on a more industrial scale.
Oh, my God.
But milking an actual pigeon naturally would be really challenging. I've never drank it.
It looks good on your resume. Has anybody ever made cheese out of it?
No. I would be really horrified. But there are some pretty horrible.
But you know you would try it. Would absolutely try it.
Oh, I might. Yeah. Okay. You've got me pegged.
Now, there's so much you when you get into the genetics of pigeons, because when people look at a flock of pigeons, one of the first things hopefully you'll notice, especially after reading this book, is that there's a lot of differences from one bird to the next. But there's been a lot of domestic breeds, and you talk about this in the book. I once went to a fowl show. It happens every year out in Springfield. And I'd never been to something like that before. And there were all these breeds of chickens, these extraordinarily bizarre breeds of chickens and doves. And these breeds that people have created are just weird. And most of them will not survive in the wild.
I like to say that it's similar to fancy dog breeding. Many parallels between dogs and pigeons in this book, but I think it's pretty warranted. It's just that with dogs, we remember why they were domesticated. But pigeons, you know, because they've been domesticated for so many thousands of years, were also subdivided into really fancy breeds. And they look absurd until you sort of compare them. Well, they still look absurd, but you can compare them to dog breeds. So there are, you know, Great Dane dogs. And then in pigeons, you've got the Hungarian giant house pigeons.
They have great names, too.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Yeah. There's, you know, the owl pigeons have these little tiny, round, almost pug-like faces. There are Saxon fairy swallows and archangels. Yeah, they're really fantastic.
But nobody's ever bred a dog that can't feed itself.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a complicated issue. So they are typically able to feed themselves for the most part. What they can't do always is feed their young.
Well, it's the Jacobin, I think, breed specifically really needs help feeding itself.
Yeah, well, so you need to sort of trim the feathers around their head in order to. So they had they're this breed. It will not surprise anyone that they were a favorite of Queen Victoria. They have this like basically feather boa ruffle thing that goes all around their head and neck. It's basically feathers that grow up instead of down, and so they can't really see around them. So when you look at a population of feral pigeons, you can think of it like a pack of stray dogs. These are the creatures that are a mix of breeds, but some of the more extreme breeds would have been picked off by predators or wouldn't have survived super long in the wild. So the ones that we have in the wild of pigeons are a little less spectacular than the Jacobins or the giant house pigeons.
Now, you do have some fascinating information, and actually it was new to me, and I really am using it to watch pigeons in the wild. There are base color varieties, and what are they?
Yeah, this was some interesting work coming out of the lab of Dr. Michael Shapiro from University of Utah. Although it's stuff that pigeon breeders have been looking at for a really, really long time, too. So there's a lot to pigeon genetics, but there's this basic body color, which is kind of this, there's this blue color, there's a brown color, and there's an ash red color. And a lot of what happens to pigeons is sort of like built on top of these basic body colors. And so you see that a fair amount. You know, you'll see the sort of brownish ones, or you'll see the bluish ones. And that stuff is really neat. And it's all sort of controlled by this one gene, which is also really fascinating, too. So then you can get into dominance and recessiveness and all of that fun genetic stuff.
Are, within any one pigeon flock, are all of them different from each other?
You know, it's a little hard to tell from just looking, because some of the genetics isn't necessarily expressed in terms of how they look. So two birds that, you know, are white, for example, might have different genetics behind that.
Got it.
I feel like for the most part, you will kind of see the same, at least general repeating patterns. You'll see, you know, for example, there are bar-winged pigeons where you'll see two bars on their wing, and then you'll see the more checkered ones that have kind of a checkered-y wing. And that is really cool, because it looks like that comes from an African bird called the African speckled pigeon that humans intentionally bred with Columba livia, or city pigeon, at some point in the past for reasons we do not understand. And those genes are, you know, visible in cities today, which I think is so incredible.
I'm always fascinated within a city how pigeon flocks wander. And one of the great things is if you can start to recognize individual pigeon patterns like this, we were talking about the colors, and it's all explained in the book, that you could actually see a pigeon one place and actually find it and recognize it as an individual in another location.
Yeah, I did this years and years ago when I lived in the Canadian city of Toronto. There was one pigeon that I was especially fond of because I saw him eating a giant Kaiser bun, so I named him Kaiser. And he had had a very cool piebald pattern. And you can start to recognize individual patterns because, you know, with all the complex genetics, they're kind of like snowflakes. They're sort of general types. But you can see just the most incredible birds that you wouldn't see anywhere else if you look at your flock. So that makes it more fun, I think.
Yeah. And some of them have more feathered feet than others?
Yeah, that's another interesting genetic thing, is that there are some breeds that express feathers on their legs, and it's kind of cool. It's a wing gene that's being expressed in their legs, so they're basically growing wings on their legs. And some of the breeds, like the fairy swallows or other birds, have these giant wing legs. Basically,
I actually saw some of those.
Oh gosh, yeah,
they were freaky. That was disturbing and bizarre.
They wouldn't do so well if you dump them in the city.
But there'll be a lot of happy Cooper's hawks.
Yeah, exactly. Or even, you know, something that's less usually able to eat a pigeon would be like, hey, bonanza. But yeah, you can see these at least a more kind of subdued version of that in city pigeons. So a lot of them will have a little bit of feathering on their feet, and that is, you know, definitely from human intervention and human breeding, basically selecting for that cool trait and then breeding it. So I like to think they have little boots, like they're maybe a little warmer in the winter.
And they also have multi-hued toenails, and I never knew that.
Yeah, it's funny. I feel like there would be sort of two reactions to that fact, like, oh wow, that's so cool, or why are you talking about pigeon toenail colors? But it's one of those things where the more you go down this rabbit hole, the more you realize, you know, there are with these stray birds, these really cool kind of piebald or patchy patterns that you'll get, and that also extends to their toes. Their bills can also be different colors too. Their eyes can be different colors. There's just an incredible variety of these birds.
We just have a few minutes left, and we haven't even started to talk about one of the great things about pigeons is they have really obvious behaviors that anybody can pick up on and learn about.
Yeah, there's a huge section in my book that's all about observing pigeon behaviors. And I think that's one of the most fun things is if you spend some time, you notice some of the colors, you'll start to see really funny stuff. So, for instance, they have a really complex courtship. They mate for life. They impress their mates with this really multi-step romantic plan that is
amazing to watch. It is incredible to watch.
Yeah, and I have, you know, a several-step guide in there if you feel like learning some moves from these pigeons.
We're out of time. We could talk about this book for hours. It's a wonderful guide to animal behavior and a bird that we can all watch because most of us are close to pigeons somewhere. My guest tonight has been Rosemary Mosco, science communicator, author, and creator of the webcomic Bird and Moon, which is another topic for discussion we've got to have. She has written and illustrated A Pocket Guide to Pigeon Watching, Getting to Know the World's Most Misunderstood Bird. Rosemary, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Mark. This was a total delight.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.